Domingo has been acting in the theater for decades, but in the last few years, he's made a vivid impression in films like Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and Zola, and most recently in Euphoria, where he plays a recovering addict that cancels Rue, played by Zendaya, the main character. In a standalone episode that was shot during the pandemic, which was set in a diner, Domingo was riveting. This year, Domingo was nominated for an Emmy for his outstanding work on the show. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Coleman Domingo to Five Things. One, two, three, four, five. Questions with Len. Questions with Len. Okay, so the way we begin Five Things is to first talk about a person who's been particularly important or meaningful in your life. Who would that person be?
I thought long and hard about this, and I wanted to say my friend Michelle Lloyd Maya. Mm. Michelle is a woman I've known since I was 19 years old in Philadelphia. And she's been instrumental in many steps, and one was a major step in my life. I met her when we were catering at a place called Day by Day Caterers in Philadelphia, where she actually hired me. You know, I was needing some money and a gig, and so she helped me do that. But she also taught me about sort of design and the way she laid out food. And I think she was just teaching me a lot about culture and wine and things like that. And she's an elegant, tall, beautiful woman, you know, African-American. She always wore big hats and she's just very, very graceful. So I just love the way we still don't know exactly how we met. We believe we met through some mutual friends, but eventually it was just me and her always. When I was about to leave Philadelphia and move to San Francisco to embark on an endeavor of being an actor, she let me move into her apartment, and I slept on her couch. I slept on her couch, and she gave me a job. I slept on her couch, and then she did the most beautiful thing that really set me off on my course. I was working just trying to save money, and she did the most beautiful thing for me. My parents moved to Virginia maybe a month before I was thinking to move to San Francisco. And I was saving enough money to get a flight to go and stay with my friend Guy Talley, who lived in San Francisco with three other guys in a studio apartment in the Tenderloin District. So I would be the fourth person. You know, you do things like that when you're 20 years old. So, I knew I could go back to college because I was taking a break from college to save some money. And I thought, well, I'll go to San Francisco and be with those guys. And my money finally came in and I bought a ticket, a one-way ticket, but I had nothing else. I had enough to get the ticket, and the ticket finally came in. And I remember that day when it finally came in, because it was back in the day when you had, you know, FedEx had to deliver it. And you had to go down to the station and pick it up, you know, the hard copy of the ticket. And so I remember it finally arrived the morning of my flight. We rushed over there, and she's like, so how are you going to support yourself? Do you have any money over there? And I said, no, because I was really going with nothing but a dream. And I was going to stay with my friend Guy, and he was like, you know, going to offer me, you know, I could stay for a month for free. I would get a job immediately. And Michelle, I remember she reached into her purse and just got every ounce of money she had. It was like $75. And she put it in my hands. She says, go, go. And I was like, please, no. She said, no, go. Be everything you're supposed to be. And she's been still one of my lifelong friends. I count her as sort of a life coach at times. She does mindfulness coaching. And so she's always somebody who's been there at such significant times in my life, whether it's the passing of my parents or making huge life decisions. But she really is an angel to me. And we've had a bond for so long. And a lot of times it's funny because even in my career, she has no idea what I do because she's not on social media. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also been important to her. So she always just knows me. And she's never sort of a fan of me, but she is a fan of me, of the real me, you know?
Did you want to be an actor from when you were very young?
I didn't, Lynn. I was actually very shy. The idea of me being an actor is so far away from my experience up until I was about 18 years old. When I was in college, I took an acting class just as an elective because I was pretty shy out in public, but my family knew me as being funny and having lots of personality. And so my mother suggested me taking an elective that would sort of bring me out of my shell. And I took an acting class where my teacher, Chris, told me he believed that I had a gift.
And what was your first part?
My first part, my first professional part was actually...
What was your first part in that class?
Oh, my part in that class? I don't even know. All I know is there were a lot of acting exercises, and he would give us scripts. I remember he would give us things from like Christopher Durang. Christopher Durang was always being passed out in our class. And so,
was it a Catholic school or something? He's so Catholic. Was it a Catholic school or something?
I don't know. It wasn't like, well, I guess Temple University actually is a Catholic. It used to be a Catholic university. So maybe it does have something to do with that. But it was like a lot of Chris Durang.
Because he's subversive and transgressive about the Catholic Church.
Yeah, he really does all the time, right?
Yeah. Did you feel immediately at home on stage? Did you find yourself agreeing with your teacher?
I did, because my major was journalism. And the thing that Chris said to me after, this class, he pulled me and this one young woman aside. I'll never forget it. He just pulled the two of us aside. I said, can I talk to you both? And he said, yeah. He said, you're really good. And you both have incredible gifts in this field. And I think neither one of us were majoring in acting. And he said, I would be very curious if you pursued this path. I believe it has something for you. Huh. And so I started taking classes at the Walnut Street Theater School off campus, because I was there. I think that nobody would ever think that I would be an actor. So I kind of didn't want anybody sort of to crush this possible dream. Mm-hmm. So I took classes off campus, and I was, I would lay on the floor and do breathing exercises. And, they always say, fill your, body with orange juice. And, all these seem hippy dippy weird, acting exercises. But I did find myself, I felt like I found home. And I also found, more than anything, a community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I was always seeking, people who were sort of as weird as I was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And nerdy. And when it comes to research, because a lot of my work involves just, so much research. And I love being in the library and being in encyclopedias and learning about everything. So it satisfied that need in me. So I think that it was a perfect fit.
And what was your first part that you did professionally?
My first part that I did professionally was in a high school touring company, Theater for Young Audiences, at the New Conservatory Theater Center. And it was a play called The Inner Circle. And so picture it, Lynn, this is the early 90s. And so basically it was really about age education to high school kids and junior high school kids. So I played a young boy dying of AIDS. And really talking about it with his, it's very heavy material for kids, but that was what our mission was. And we would pack up the sets and open up the sets and hang lights and everything. And we would perform. And when I look back at it now, I was
So you were dying again and again and again and again?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I would do like three shows a day, and I was a very raw actor because I had zero skill, but I had a lot of, heart. And yeah. So I know that now when I look back, like when I would cry, I would sob. There was no technical skill at all. It was just a raw, open wound on stage. And then eventually I would, everything I've learned, Lynn, is by practicing. It's, I really learned as a craftsman, being in rehearsals that I wasn't even called for, to learn from people who knew what they were doing. So I've learned from reading books and reading Stanislavski and Uta Hagen and having truly a respect for the craft.
Huh. Amazing. And what was your first job in San Francisco when you went there?
My first job in San Francisco? I worked at a place called the Kennel Club, and I worked as a bartender. And again, Lynn, this is going to sound terrible. I don't know. I'll call it acting. But I actually lied. I actually lied and said I had bartending experience, and I did not. because there was an ad and they were looking for dancers. I'm like, I dance, I move. And they were looking for dancers for their club. And I said, I'll dance. And so I went there and they hired all the dancers. They said, yeah, but we're looking for a bartender. Have you bartended? I said, yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if charm got me over and I was skinny and with a big smile and 21 years old. and they took a chance on me. And so what I did was I would read bartending books in the daytime and experiment with my roommates. And then I would go on the job and make cocktails. And then I learned very quickly that as long as it's strong, nobody really cares. And it's the same color. I was a terrible bartender, I'm sure. But everyone got their fill when they came to my bar.
And what was your outfit? What was the uniform or whatever?
Oh, my God. Well, there was no uniform. It was actually like a bar club where you can wear what you want. And so, you know, I was in my early 20s, so I was experimenting and figuring out my body. And the guy who I worked next to named Sherrod, there was two guys usually and two girls. And it was like, they had different nights. They had a world beat night, you know, with like African and Caribbean music. And then they would have a night that is like a gay and lesbian night. And then they would have other bands that would come in. So on any night, you would sort of dress thematically. I wear dashiki one night, and then I wear like tight pants laced in the front. And I would experiment with a crop top, you know.
You found out what got the best tips.
I got some good tips. I got some.
I bet you
again,
did.
I think I was a popular bartender because I just overpoured the alcohol.
So the next question would be, what place has particular meaning for you?
You know what? I immediately thought of this area in northern Baja called Valle de Guadalupe.
I don't know that. Huh.
Valle de Guadalupe is like the wine region of Baja California. Oh. And it's basically just you go over the border from San Francisco, you hit Rosarito, and then you go a little further down and make a left and drive inland for about 45 minutes. Mm. And the wines are incredible. The restaurants are beautiful. The land, if you feel like you're in Italy.
Wow.
And not many people know about it, but they have like 5-star hotels. And there's a place called Encuentro Guadalupe that is a beautiful hotel that I always stay in that is very much, you know, earth conscious. I don't know. It's just a beautiful place because what I love, I lived in Mexico off and on for a couple of years when I was shooting Fear the Walking Dead there. Mm-hmm. And I got to know Mexico in a way that really, it really blew my mind because I think that, you know, I think we've all been in, a lot of times we've been indoctrinated in having a belief about Mexico and its people. And I got to know people so beautifully and how warm people are in Mexico and how much history and classy and, I don't know, just I think the, you know, innovative. So I just spent a lot of time there. Whenever I wasn't shooting, I would drive to Valle de Guadalupe and just drive around and I would lay in fields and I would think and I feel closer to the earth. To be honest.
Huh. That's so beautiful. Have you ever gone back to living on the East Coast or after you came out to California, did you just stay in California or around California?
No, I was in San Francisco for 10 whole years. And then I moved to New York and I was there for 16 years. And then it sort of happened while I was, you know, I was shooting Fear the Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. And I honestly feel like I got a little soft because, you know, I was living, you know, by the water and laying in fields and eating tacos every day. And I'll go back to New York and I'm like, it's too noisy for me.
Yeah.
And I realized I changed. Our relationship changed. So
Too cold. Yeah, too cold.
Yeah, I sort of crept out of New York. I sort of got another apartment in LA and I was going back and forth and being a bit bi-coastal. And then at some point, I sort of like a thief of the night started moving more things to LA. Because it felt like that relationship, like I was sort of cheating on New York.
You broke up with New York. You decided to not be married anymore.
Yeah, we broke up, you know, but you know, I let New York keep their apartment.
You know, did.
I had a rent-stabilized apartment in Midtown. So, I also thought, I think there's something energetic, honestly, Lynn, about I was in a beautiful rent-stabilized apartment. And at some point, it honestly felt unfair. It's like, you know, as I started to, you know, make a really good living doing what I was doing, I was like, no, this apartment is meant for someone else. It's meant for the next generation of people to come in and strive like I was. So let me give it up and just let that energy flow, to be honest.
That's an incredibly generous attitude. I know people who've held on to rent-stabilized apartments. Like
I know, you know, I'm sure people want that apartment still. You know, but, you know,
yeah, exactly.
People are always shocked that I was giving up because it's an apartment. I lived in an apartment building called Manhattan Plaza.
I know it well. Yes, Manhattan Plaza.
Yeah, yeah. I lived there. You
on
know,
50th Street, right? 50th?
Yeah, on 43rd Street.
Yeah,
some people call it the home for wayward actors because it's because it's rent stabilized for at least 70% of the population of performing artists. And that's what really sort of rebuilt Hell's Kitchen. And so I feel like people have been generous to me. That apartment building was generous to me. And you have to pass it on. I think that that's just something the way we all must live.
I'm very impressed because I must tell you, I'm not sure most people do that. I think they
no, they don't.
They beg,
that's
borrow,
when I give
beg,
it, when I gave up the apartment, the people down in the offices thought I was, I think they thought that I was actually losing my mind because they asked me three times, so you are giving up the apartment? And then they used the word like, are you giving, what did they use the word like, I forget, releasing the apartment. They asked me like three times, like it was a sanity test. I said, no, yeah, I'm moving to LA. I'm good.
Good for you. And did you have any regrets when you moved to LA? Did you miss the East Coast?
No. And that's something that my friends always probably don't like to hear. Every time I go back, they're like, oh, don't you miss it? Don't you miss living here? And I'm like, absolutely not. Because I think I served my time. I dreamed those dreams. I walked those streets. I treaded the boards. I did everything I believe I was supposed to do in that chapter of my life, which was I grew a lot. You know, I spent my 20s in San Francisco, my 30s in New York, and I believe, well, my 30s and partially in my 40s. And I thought, hey, for my 40s, 50s, I think I need hikes and being by the ocean and I don't know, just a different way of life.
Yeah, New York kind of kicks your ass in a way that's exhausting. Basically,
Len, yeah. It does. And I think after a while, I just don't like the idea of walking out of my building and things are going to happen to you. That sounds so... Because I feel like that's what I, you know, when you're young, you're like, yeah, something's going to happen when I walk out of the door, when I go down the subway. I don't like that anymore. I'm 52, going to be 53 years old. And I'm like, I like to know when I walk out, what's going to happen is because I sort of designed it.
So tell me a thing. It can be a painting, a photograph, something that's inanimate that has meaning for you.
Well, what I thought of was a song.
You could do a song.
Okay, I can do a song. There's a song by The Spinners, and The Spinners is a group that was on Philadelphia International.
Yes, I know.
Do you know that song, Sadie? And they would go, early one Sunday morning, breakfast was on the table. But basically, it's a song that the lead singer sang about his mother and talking about the memory of his mom and how wonderful she was and how strong she was and how they would sing to her, Sadie, don't you know we love you, sweet Sadie? And my mother's name was Edie. And me and my siblings would turn the song into Edie because I think the song, anytime I hear that song, it makes me think of my mom. It feels like it describes her. And so I always change the name to hers. She hasn't been with me since 2006. But every time I hear that song, I think of her. So that song just has beautiful meaning and makes me think of her and her smile and the way she was and being fun and funny and silly and also very spiritual.
Did she love seeing your work?
She did. She didn't get to see a lot of it because as she passed before I sort of had some more, I guess, more successes. Like, you know, she didn't get to see a lot of my work in the theater.
Uh-huh.
Because by then they lived in Virginia when I had more of a theater career. But she did see a few things and she read my writing and she really loved it. And I didn't know for a long time that I believe I get my writing from my mom. Yeah, because my mother would every so often share some poetry with me.
Oh, wow.
And I would look at her like, who is this woman? And I started to, you know what I mean? After what, I think all hopefully kids and adults go through that where you actually turn and look at your mom and you're like, wait a minute, you're a whole person. And you actually write about things that are interesting. that have nothing to do with being my mother. Mm-hmm. Who are you? You know?
What do you think you inherited most from your mom?
Her love of people.
That's so wonderful.
My mother and my stepfather, they would have parties all the time. They taught me how to be sociable because they just loved being great hosts. Okay. Every 4th of July, every New Year's Eve, the parties were at our house. Barbecues, birthdays, you name it. They loved hosting. And then my mother, when I was a kid, I would be slightly annoyed that we would walk down the street in Philadelphia and my mother talked to everybody. Mm. And she constantly did that, spoke to every banker, every clerk. She had full, but not just spoke, but had full conversations and got to know them. So my mother was sort of like the mayor of West Philadelphia. And then even as my mother, I remember when my mother had lupus and she got very ill. And I remember I took her to a CVS and she kept doing the same thing. She was standing there, oh, hi, Sheila. How's your mom? How's she doing? She talked to everybody. I'm like, oh my God, mom, why are you talking to everybody? And I realized I'm just like her. She loved people and she really was a people person and she needed that. And I realized that, you know, in my life, I absolutely do the same thing. I'm always hosting and having people over and I'm very interested in people.
Uh-huh. And do you find that people are interested in what you're doing or you as a person or both?
I like to, it's funny, I think as sort of, how can I say this and say this well? I am more interested in people knowing me as a person.
Right.
My closest friends and colleagues, like I would say Anika Noni Rose, we've known each other for such a long time. She's one of my dearest friends. Most of the time, we have no idea what each other are doing professionally.
Oh, wow.
When we go on the phone, like, I know she's, like, I would talk to her on the phone. I'm like, I know she's in New York doing a series. Do I know exactly what it is? No. She knows I'm doing a movie. Does she know exactly how it's going in the days? Not really. Because when we get on the phone, we have so much more to talk about than just what's happening in our careers. And I really do value that with my friendships. You know, I think when I have a friend who just says, hey, so what are you up to? And if the intention is to talk about my career, I actually bristle a little bit because I'm like, that's not the most interesting thing to me. I mean, that's my work and I love it. And I think there's a time for it. But usually when you say, what are you up to? I'm like, you know, just going to go hang out and barbecue. Because I think you're talking about me as a person. But like, if you want me to list my resume, then you're taking me back to work. I've got to unpack all of that. And I think that that's what I love. But maybe I compartmentalize a bit.
Yeah.
The people who love and care about me. Also know, like when you come into my house, you know, my home is meant for love and entertaining and laying by the pool and having a meal. There's nothing that tells you that I'm an actor mm-hmm. in that house or I do anything. It tells me I'm a human and I like art and sculpture and architecture and, you know, travel. It tells you much more, a bigger picture, you know?
Well, I have to say though, when I saw your work in Euphoria, I was, especially the standalone episode, I just was so overwhelmed by your intensity and the depth of that performance. I mean, I thought about it for days and then I watched it about three more times. And I was happy that you came back because I didn't know if you were going to come back or not. And congratulations on your Emmy nomination, which you should have had for the standalone episode as well. Was that particularly difficult to do, or was that, it felt so deep in you?
You know why, Len? It's because Sam sent me that script, and what was that about?
Sam Levinson.
Sam Levinson sent me the script in about August of 2020, when people were still outraged at George Floyd's death and, you know, the pandemic is raging and I'm sitting on the, I'm literally, you know, we're watching day by day, you know, fires in the street, not knowing which way to turn. And so I think that I just had so much feeling inside of me. And Sam, when I read that script, it called on everything. It felt like a sermon. It felt like something I could pour all these feelings into. Mm-hmm. And so basically I rehearsed it upwards of like at least for 40 hours a week for 3 weeks to get myself up to speed with it, because I knew it required that. I wanted to challenge myself with sort of the act of, I didn't want it to feel like a performance at all. I wanted it to feel like breath. I wanted it to feel like you're just talking to your neighbor or your brother, that someone really is entering your space in the most private way. I think a lot of things in my career have lent on me being a bit more performative, and this required something a bit more quiet. And so I wanted to work it and work it and work it so you don't see it. And then I honestly feel like that was such a gift, not only to me, but for audiences. It was the first thing I did when we started going back to work in September of 2020, I believe. Was that September I did? And I think why it's so powerful is because we all knew we had such gratitude to be doing what we're doing. And we had text to support what we hope to put out into the world and how we really believe that we can animate change. That was my march. That was my prayer. That was my tearing down systems, was that collaboration with Sam Levinson and Zendaya on that episode. And so I knew this was something I can put my entire soul into and everything that I'm feeling that I can't give words to. And I feel so grateful. I always believe that the art will arrive that will help move you to another place, or help, you know, soothe something in your heart, or help you change something. And it arrived. And there was this moment. This one arrived. This was it.
It's a remarkable piece of work. And it's also works on so many levels, you know, because on the one hand, there's so much rage in it. And then there's so much, and there's also so much hope.
There's hope and there's
and
grace.
Passion.
Yeah. And passion. Hope, passion, and grace. Mm. What the thing that I wanted to center myself on with that episode is the conversation about redemption and how human that is, because I think that we live in a world where people have taken redemption off the table. And I think that's the most inhumane thing to do, whether you're dealing with people who have been, you know, suffering from the disease of addiction or incarceration, that everyone has an opportunity to come back into society. I think it requires many things, like accountability, to do the work, because we're all fragile. We all make mistakes, but we all, if we try, are trying to get better. And we have to, I believe, that's the most human thing that we can do, is have our hands open and welcome someone back and say, I forgive you, you know? And that's what, I think a lot of that was embedded in that episode, because I think that my character, Ali, is also searching for forgiveness.
What did you do it? How did you lose it? Was it true? Do you remember? Were you confused when you thought you knew? Now you see through it. You can tell her.
So my favorite question that I ask is the thing in your life that looked like a disaster that turned out to be actually a good thing.
It's funny, Lynn. I was actually going to try to... This is such a difficult question. And I thought I centered on something that was truly affirming and changing for me, which was when I was renegotiating for a salary. And I was getting so many no's. Now, this is someone... I'm very well-meaning about things like this, whether it's me and my team, and we provide, you know, we're patient and we provide examples and receipts of why we should move the needle on my salary for something. If I feel like I've been giving sweat equity, I've been doing work above and beyond, I've been a great representative, you name it. But a lot of times in our industry, that doesn't equal moving on your salary, until you have to start to demand and almost get a little ugly about it in some way. And I know that I had to get on the phone, not only to the CEO of this corporation, but also to the president. Mm-hmm. I also, because I realized that this became personal, because this is a company that considered me family. Uh-huh. And I didn't feel like I was being treated like the family that I know. I'm treated very well by my family. And it was extraordinary, because what I was asking for really was in every way, and they understood it by the end, that it was due, that you can't just get all the love and support from one. It can't go from one way. I always believed this. Who said this before? Betty Davis actually said it in the interview. And she says, actors will give you everything. And it's true. We'll give you everything. We'll show up. We'll do the press. We'll do this. We'll do this. I will do rewrites on a script for you. I will do this. I will show up. And then every so often you ask whether it's a studio or a network to show up for you. Mm-hmm. And then they will tell you, like they told me, oh, well, we have you on this sort of tier. Mm-hmm. So there's a tier apparently that I didn't know about that I was on. There's a tier of where my character or, and it didn't matter how much I've given to the show and the network, I was on a tier. And I thought, well, who put me on this tier? And it actually didn't make sense. It was something that was designed by business affairs in some way, but it didn't, I challenged them to think of the human and the personal and what this, the artist, because I knew this fight was not going to be about just for me. It was going to be for others as well. We need to break down this tiered system that didn't make sense to me, because I think I'm a bit more of someone who believes in a meritocracy. You know what I mean? I'm like, well, I did this work, so I think that we should look at what I give, not me and, like, I don't know, 100 other people. So I learned to speak up for myself, and I learned to take it to the mat and really speak personally to these people who could change this for me and for others. And I stood my ground and I didn't back down. I kept going with it. And I spoke to anyone who would listen, who were the higher ups. And because I think all I have is my truth. And maybe I learned this during the pandemic and Black Lives Matter, you name it, but I learned to just speak up more and say, I don't think it's right. And I think you have to reexamine this and look at what I've actually done and what I've give and how I've done so much for so little.
Was it scary? Was it scary to do that?
At this time, it wasn't. And I'll tell you what, there was another, I think events converge. I was also, at the time, I was sitting in Shiva for my friend, Ari Gold, who was a singer-songwriter who passed away at 47 years old. Mm. So I was feeling a bit raw and feeling a bit like, I want to right some wrongs. You know, and I think possibly I was feeling that about him and his passing. So I felt like I had armor, and I was like, no, I have to give them all that I have and speak my truth. And that's all I have. And then I actually just wiped my hands on it and said, you heard my position. I remember the CEO called me again and asked me if I wanted to talk about it anymore. And this is after many meetings from my team with their business affairs. And I said, no. I've said everything I need to say. It's now on you. And I walked away from it. Hmm. And then maybe about 3 weeks later, my reps called me and said, hey, we got a phone call and they would like to move your salary.
Wow.
And they did. Not to the point where I thought I still deserved, but they realized that there was an error in their thinking. Because they were not thinking, I don't think, and I can tell them this to their face. They were not thinking about their person. They were thinking about their numbers. Yeah. And I wanted to challenge them and let them know that I am no one's number and not any other artist, I think, worth their salt. You have to look at us as human beings. I'm very clear when I tell people I love them or I say that we're family. Don't say that we're family. Because I don't belong to a dysfunctional family. I want my family to treat me fairly. And well, and wholly, and lovingly, and really think of the person that they're working with. You know,
during that 3 weeks, what did you feel?
During that 3 weeks, I felt angry. I felt sad. I felt like I was lied to. Then there's those moments in your career where you feel like I've done so much, and I feel like I've earned it. And then you feel like, and I know I'm not the only person who will say this. You feel like, why am I still having these fights? Yeah. You feel like, by now, why can't someone just give me the offer that is fair? That's all. I'm just asking for something that's fair. Don't try to think that I don't understand what my worth is. Mm-hmm. But I think they always challenge you with your worth. And I think that you always have to continue to, like, dig deep. And I think that's what I did. I just dug a little deeper. But to be honest, it really bummed me out. I sat One night I sat at my kitchen counter and just sobbed because I was exhausted and tired of having these same arguments and feeling like I always have to fight for my worth. You know, like, why isn't, you know, you, and of course, I'm sure I'm human. I feel like I look to the side of me and you think, it feels like other people have it easier. Yeah. I have to, you know, and maybe it calls on something that, you know, I come from a very humble place in West Philly where, you know, my parents worked, you know, we're just working class people and I've worked for everything that I have. And I felt like at some point you just want a little break. You want somebody to say, hey, we're going to give you your worth. Hey, we're going to give you that thing. Hey, you don't have to, you don't have to fight and work harder than anyone to get it, you know?
Yep, I do.
So I think it brought up my own demons. It brought up my own thing, the thing that hurts that I feel like I've worked on. And I'm like, oh, you're making me hurt again. You're making me feel like I'm that poor kid from West Philly that has to fight for everything. And no matter what I've done, you're going to still make me work for it and tell me I'm not worthy. And I have to dig deeper and say I am worthy.
And then it worked out.
And then it worked out. It did work out. It worked out in a few ways. And I think that's the lesson. I think that's the thing that helped me learn to speak up for myself. And truly, you know, people say this all the time, but like about standing in your truth, it's like, yeah, I have to stand in it because that's all I have.
Yep. Wow. Well, good for you. That's a great accomplishment because you did it yourself.
Yeah. And also with people around me, also the people who love me, where they support me everywhere. People talk about their team. I almost don't like to use that term because the people who I work with have become my family. They are brothers and sisters to me who love me and I love them. And we look out for each other. So I know that they were standing shoulder to shoulder to make sure that I got my worth.
Wow. I love that story. And tell me a purely joyful time in your life.
Oh, this is my favorite question. And the first thing I thought of is when I was about 6 or 7, when I would get a cold, I would have terrible bronchitis. And one time it was so bad that I was hospitalized.
Oh, wow.
And I think I was hospitalized for at least a couple of weeks. And it was right around my birthday, which is because it was around Thanksgiving. And I was hospitalized. And so I was in the hospital for my birthday. And I remember, but there was a kid. I remember I had a shared room and there was a kid next to me who was always asleep. And I have that vision right now. It was just always like, what's going on with that kid? And I was worried about him. And I was just like, you know, sit and I would just read books and wait for my mom to come visit me. And I had a little thing that you put over a breathing apparatus thing. Yeah. And then my breathing would get better. And I got better. And then it was finally time for me to go home. And I remember we walked by the kid and I remember my mother, she said, just say a little prayer for him. We said a little prayer. And then we went and got into the car and my older brother and older sister were in the car. And we get in the car and we're driving through Philadelphia at night. And I see all these lights everywhere. Mm. Now, remember, I went into the hospital right before Thanksgiving. And it came out and there were Christmas lights everywhere. And my mom's, and I said, oh my God, look at all the lights. And she says, oh, they put all their lights up to welcome you home.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Everybody put up all these lights to welcome you home. So I thought all the lights were for me.
Oh, so sweet.
And I just thought, I was so happy that my mother always made me believe that the world was mine, that the world shined on me and everybody was thinking about that little boy who had bronchitis and came home and was well.
She gave you that gift.
She really did. My mother gave me the biggest gift and that was of imagination. She always dreamed and we talked about places we wanted to see and go. And, you know, I come from a very poor family, but we had a very active imagination. And I think that imagination is what has brought me to, I don't know, sitting here on this podcast talking to you, Len.
Well, I think it's more than that, although this is a wonderful conversation and I really feel very grateful for you talking to me. And thank you so much. I really enjoyed it so much.
Thank you, Len. I look forward to seeing you again soon out in the world, okay?
Yes, I look forward to seeing you and congratulations on everything.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye. Thanks so much for listening to Five Things with Lynn Hirschberg. The podcast is produced by Michael Becker with sound engineering by Rich Zerbini and Max Solomon at the Hangar Studios and additional audio engineering by Kara Johnson. The theme song was written and performed by Blondin Carr. Special thanks to Sarah Moonves, editor-in-chief of W Magazine, and, as always, Zora. Don't forget to follow W Magazine on Instagram or wmagazine.com. And please subscribe to our YouTube channel where you can watch my screen test videos with people like Penelope Cruz, Denzel Washington, and George Clooney. Thanks again.